I wanted to be with you alone, but they said I needed a co-host. So then I reached out to this guy. He said I have stems. Now, this is so much better. Some songs give you all of the feels, and this is one song that gives us all of the feels. Some songs give you all of the feels. I am DLO, this is luxury. You're listening to one song.
Luxury, my man, what's up?
DLO, my friend, how are you today? How are things going?
Things are great. It's a gray day.
It is a little overcast.
Los Angeles, but I will say that it is bright and colorful in the world of music.
I'm glad we're talking about the weather, a little foreshadowing of the song we're going to talk about today.
Very
right?
Nice.
Exactly.
I see what you did there.
So in the introduction, we usually start with a few superlatives, and today's episode is no different. But this superlative is particularly superlatively special.
Oh, brother.
Because this time on one song, we're talking about Diallo Riddle's number one, all-time greatest karaoke go-to song.
It's my karaoke song. That's true, Luxury. And honestly, we should just stop right there because there is no greater accolade or honor for a song than being belted out by yours truly in a Koreatown karaoke booth at 2 a.m.
That's right. But while we're here, we may as well say a little more about the song. So the band we're talking about today had two mega hits from their second album, Songs from the Big Chair. Shout and Everybody Wants to Rule the World both went to number one in America. But the song we're talking about today did not.
So why are we talking about it? Because even if it's not the band's biggest hit, it's an anthem in its own right.
Yeah.
After its initial release in 1985, it got a new lease on life and found a fresh audience when it was featured on the Donnie Darko soundtrack in 2001. Around that time, Vice.com, RIP, said the song is, quote, absurdly brilliant. And the accompanying music video is also a classic.
It's bonkers.
And because it's a music video from the 1980s, of course it includes a sexy librarian, a dude in a World War II gas mask, and a chimp in a Red Sox uniform, which
obviously
makes him the most mature Red Sox fan on the planet. Shout out to Boston.
All right, so if you haven't guessed already, this time on one song, we are talking about Tears for Fears, and the song is Head Over Heels.
Thanks to the U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Just like notes in a song, sustainable living is just a series of small, eco-friendly choices that contribute to the melody. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on At Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm actor, writer, director, and sometimes DJ, Diallo Riddle.
And I'm producer, DJ, and songwriter, Luxury, a.k.a. the guy who talks about
interpolation
on TikTok.
Oh, my gosh.
So
you did not tell me you were going
to
do that.
I'm so proud of myself.
I'm so glad you're proud of yourself.
To bring in the recording of the official interpolation
whisper. What is happening?
And today we are somewhere new. If you're watching this on YouTube or on social media, you'll see our brand new set. But for the benefit of our listeners on SiriusXM or on the podcast, I will describe it to you. We are inside an eco-friendly, sustainable studio that has been designed for us by our friends at the United Soybean Board.
That's right. No more studio built out of trees from the rainforest for us.
Absolutely.
We've gone sustainable.
It's about time, too.
By the way, these prints on the wall, for those watching at home, they're made with soy ink. This chair I'm sitting in, believe it or not, is made from soy leather. And all the vintage items in here, like this boombox, are all repurposed, some actually repossessed from my Uncle Carl. So this is all sustainable stuff. It's so cool. We're really excited to be here.
Yeah. All right, so Tears for Fears, let's start here. At the top, we mentioned that this is your favorite karaoke song.
It is.
Why? What makes it such a fun
Man,
song to
it's
sing?
It's got so many fun parts, and
You know, I've struggled with this persistent cough situation. I'm on a million antibiotics all winter long. I can't do it right now, but like the thing I like about it is that he goes from full voice to falsetto.
Yes, we're going to talk about that big time.
Also, like, it's a smart, I mean, like, this is usually a pejorative. It's a smart song. Yeah. Like, the lyrics, there's certain songs you just want to get up there and you want to sing lyrics like, and I dream that I'm a doctor. You know, like, you just like those kind of things.
Yeah,
it's like a, you know,
animals
dry curious poses. Like, you're like, who writes that?
Yeah, that one's weird.
I think there was like a premium on amazing lyrics in this period of the 80s, and we're going to get into that.
Every time you sing like a Duran Duran song, you're like, what is happening in this song? No idea what these lyrics mean. But in this song,
Save
it's very clear.
Save a prayer for me now.
Very clear what's happening in this one. It's a love song, and it's fun to both belt and go into that head voice for the falsetto stuff. I totally get it.
I mean, also, there's the fact that this song is like right in my register. So I can, you like you said, I like to belt it out. I can truly belt out this song.
Yeah.
It's got great lyrics. There's emotion. It's got a lot of things to check my boxes. This song came out in the mid-80s. Take me back to when you first heard this song.
I would have heard this song when I was in seventh grade, and it would have just been the perfect seventh grade. You know, it's funny because Tears for Fears, up until this moment, their second album, they're a super angst-ridden band.
Uh-huh.
Their first record is called The Hurting. There's a song called Suffer Little Children, Mad World. Like, everything about the band is
Pale
about...
Pale Shelter.
Pale Shelter. There's angst. There's anxiety. There's childhood trauma. Luckily, I did not suffer that myself, but I felt the feelings of the songs. This song comes out. I love the band, and it's expressing this new emotion for the band, which is love. And in seventh grade, you know, you're starting to flower. You're starting to not be like, oh, I hate girls anymore. That, like, vibe starts to go away. You're having your first school dances and stuff. So this song really cuts to the chase for me in that way, for my seventh grade self. Like, okay, there's Jeannie Heath, you know, we're slow dancing to Alphaville, Forever Young. And, you know, then this song comes on, we're dancing. And we're singing, we're belting, by the way.
You hear that, Jeannie Heath?
Jeannie
Heath, out.
If you're out there.
You missed out on it.
Never forget.
I also think it's interesting that you bring up the emotion because, to me, you know, how many times have I sung this song? When we were preparing
Thousands.
For this, the first question that was asked was, what is the song about? And I was like, I think he's head over heels in love.
Yeah.
Like, it's amazing to me that... So, you know, a good pop song can be so catchy and so emotive that you can sing these lyrics that seem like really smart lyrics and never actually take a step back and say, well, what does it mean? I think that's actually a sign of really good art.
Yes,
actually.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So Tears for Fears are a band that we're both really excited to talk about. Luxury, can you walk us through a history of the band?
Tears for Fears are from Bath, England. It's Roland Orzabal and Kurt Smith. They meet as teenagers, roughly 13, 14 years old. Roland is already writing songs, and he needs a singer because he himself does not feel like he is a good enough singer. So they become friends, and Kurt has been a singer. He sings in the choir. He loves singing. I've heard him in an interview say he doesn't like talking very much at that age. He like singing is his only means of expression. He's a very like quiet guy. So it's perfect. It's a perfect fit. Roland's already a genius songwriter. Kurt has this beautiful voice. Together, they start writing songs. And actually, Roland teaches them to play bass eventually because they get their first opportunity to be in a band. And this is around 78 or so when they're, I think, only 17 or 18. They're very young. They join a band called Graduate.
I'm looking to the right and to the left, such a beach and every direction.
So they're in this band, Graduate, and they end up quitting. And before they start their own band, though, they're briefly session musicians in this band called Neon, which also...
I love this story.
They're only briefly in this band, and they're like, we can do better. And they split, and the band actually splits into two, and Roland and Kurt form their own band. Tears for Fears. And the other guys form Naked Eyes.
Which is another great band out of this second British invasion. I mean, like, there's so many groups from this period. And you just get the sense, like, I heard somebody recently say, like, England is like a prison where, like, everybody, was that you? Like, it was like,
wasn't me.
It was like everybody in the UK music scene kind of knows each other. So it's really easy for the guys from Naked Eyes. Naked Eyes does Always There to Remind Me, which is Promises, Promises.
Promises, promises. Why do I?
But, and then these other guys go off and form Tears for Fears, and they're all listening to OMD.
Yeah.
They're all listening to...
That's right.
To...
They're all listening to Gary Newman. They're all Gary listening
Newman.
To the same
Can I just
stuff.
Say,
yeah.
Real friends of mine know this. For years, I tried to form a DJ collective called The Friends Electric because I love the
Electric,
Gary Newman song, Our Friends
right.
Electric.
But the Friends Electric only might burn down.
And that's... well said about Naked Eyes, and a perfect opportunity to talk about the phenomenon of the synthy British duo.
Yes.
Which is kind of happening in this moment because, you know, it's not the first time we have synthy duos. Sparks, I would argue, with their Virgin Moroder-produced amazing album, Number One in Heaven, is maybe the first time we're getting synth pop with a couple of guys in that sort of top of the pops level. So the synthy British duo, Soft Cell, we've got Wham, we've got Tears for Fears, we've got Heaven 17, we've got OMD, who you mentioned. We've got Yazoo.
A lot of these groups are two dudes. It's Wham.
Synthy British
duos. They're a lot.
That's it.
Naked Eyes and Tears for Fears.
And later on, we get Pet Shop Boys, we get Erasure, we even get Goldfrapp. Two people. It's the synthy duo. So the duo energy is its own thing, and we're going to get into that because when there's two people creating together, as you and I know, and as you with your partner, it's like you are collectively doing something that the world sees as a unit, unified.
Yeah.
But what happens behind the scenes is a push and pull and a come and go that's going to come up in this story a lot.
Love that.
So in 1981, they're done doing the session musician thing or being in other people's bands. They start their own band. Initially, their first band name was History of Headaches, by the way.
Oh, my gosh.
Which they did one better, but barely, by calling it Tears for Fears. It's one of those names I think you get used to, but, like, that's kind of a crazy name, too.
It's kind of a crazy name. Yeah. It is better than History of Headaches.
It's a little bit better than History of
Nobody
Headaches.
Nobody wants that LP.
It is a little bit better than History of Headaches. So 1981, they take a cue from their shared love of this psychotherapist named Arthur Janov's book called Prisoners of Pain, which is about Primal Scream. It's about another great group. It's about Primal Scream, you're right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Another great group. But confronting your fears to eliminate them. That's the whole premise of not just the title, but their first record is like really just letting it out. Mm. And by the way, let it all out.
Yeah, I heard it.
This whole band's kind of early premise is like about like this bottled up British thing coming out through their music. It's really beautiful.
It's kind of a British thing, isn't it?
It's kind of a British
thing. They're like all like
stern.
They're like, I'm letting it out.
The guy's name is Kurt. It's very Kurt. They put out their first record, The Hurting, in 1983. It's got four massive hits on it. I should say it starts with Suffer the Children, which is maybe the least known. But then you've got Pale Shelter, Mad World, and Change, which to this day are songs that stand the test of time. Mm. Mad World, by the way, it's Kurt singing. Within the band, they have a dynamic of deciding from song to song who the singer should be.
Yeah.
Roland finally kind of comes out of his shell after thinking he's not a singer and realizes he's got a very rich, he's got the belty voice, and Kurt's got kind of the more melancholy voice.
Yeah.
So from song to song throughout the band's career, they kind of decide between the two of them who's got the right voice for the song.
I mean, it's so ironic that Roland doesn't start off as a singer because, you know, my first exposure to the band is probably Shout.
Yeah.
And like, it's like, who's this dude who's yelling?
Who's got confidence.
He's yelling
in the
mic. It was that dude.
Yeah.
To me, that guy was Tears for Fears. You could have told me, oh, that's that guy. Because there are four members of the group at this point.
Well, it's interesting you say that. We're going to get into how many members of the group are members of the group, per se, and how many members of the group are in the videos and on tour, but that's about it. And then they get cut out of royalties and publishing and all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah.
We're definitely going to get into that in a minute.
Okay, so let's get into the song Head Over Heels. And before we get into the stems, let's talk about the composition of the song Head Over Heels. How did Roland and Kurt write this song?
Okay, so the origin of this song is really interesting because it's the song, by the way, just the details, comes out in June 1985 on their second album, Songs from the Big Chair. Chris Hughes is the producer. The title of the album is, again, with this like darkness of all their lyrics and titles, and it comes from this movie, Sybil, about a schizophrenic woman whose comfort zone is the big chair.
Yeah.
So this is a song about seeking comfort, you know, in things.
Didn't know that relationship.
Yeah,
that's
right?
Really cool.
As we mentioned at the top of the show, there are two number one hits on this record in the U.S. Yeah. It is the album
that breaks them big. Massive hits.
But this is not one of them, although it did go to number three in the U.S.
Just number three. What a bunch of losers.
But Head Over Heels actually started life as the B-side of a single from 1983. Pale Shelter came out, and on the flip side was a song called We Are Broken, which I'll play you a clip from right now. And you'll probably recognize the bit that they were like, this is pretty good. Let's use this. Let's extend this maybe.
So this is a single off of their previous
album.
This
is from The Hurting, right?
And it just has this B-side.
Right.
Which
it's
I used to play.
Kind of a throwaway.
When I used to DJ,
yeah.
And I didn't know the backstory at the time, but when I used to DJ at the Standard Hotels, I used to work, longtime listeners of shows know I was a director of music and talent at the Standard Hotels. I hired the DJs, I hired the box models who went into the box behind the front desk. When I heard this, I just thought it was a weird sort of like interpolation of themselves.
Right.
Weird, I can't even say the word without whispering now.
Wait, hold on. You mean?
Interpolation.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
That's what I'm here for.
We're going to have to talk
about
the episode. But I was like, oh, that's weird how they incorporated Head Over Heels into this song. I didn't realize that Head Over Heels did not exist yet. That's super cool. To me, that's like, you know, that's like the birth of something that's going to be really important. Why is the first thing that pops in my mind Amazing Spider-Man issue number 25?
What?
Mary Jane Watson appears in the last panel of that issue, and you have no idea that she's going to become a major
that's always exciting,
character
right?
in his life yeah, for the rest yeah, yeah. Of the comic book.
And then when you go back and read it, then it's like, oh my God, she was there.
That's
I didn't
her first
even notice
panel.
It.
That's her
so
first
cool.
panel.
Nerds I had no
unite.
Idea.
Nerds across the world unite.
I had no idea we're, that
we're,
you
we're
have
rigging,
this.
We're bringing in comic books.
Is there a whole world in your, do you have like comic
oh,
book
Oh, that's a whole other brain. That's a whole
oh
other
God,
podcast.
That's
one
so
issue.
Cool.
We'll
How
do one
it
issue
come
one
up
day.
Till,
it'll never come
episode
up again.
Episode 31.
Moving on. It's really cool to hear that that's like the genesis of something that's going to be really, really special. Why does that song even exist?
So,
was it just a throwaway B-side?
Right. It's a throwaway B-side. Usually B-sides were throwaways. You didn't want to waste a song on the
sure.
B-side. That would be, you know, the album, the
Unless
single
you're
itself.
Unless some of my favorite Prince B-sides are all worthy of
yeah.
some
Oh, no.
Album
I mean, like,
yeah.
doesn't mean they're bad. It
yeah,
just
yeah,
means
yeah.
that there was a decision made to, like, not waste it
yeah, yeah,
because
yeah.
it's not going to be the focus of what they send to radio
totally.
And all that stuff. So it's a song that exists, and they start playing it live. And the evolution of it becoming its own song,
yeah.
which is really interesting because it's kind of...
It's like New Order and Blue Monday. They're like they needed a song that
right.
they could play.
Yeah,
and this is
they're
a little
filling
bit
up
of
their
that,
live.
Right?
That's right. They're kind of filling up their live set because they only have one album, so they only have like whatever a certain number of songs. And like sometimes you need more content on
it's
stage.
It's crazy. Sometimes the filler.
Yeah.
Just reaches a new level just if you have your ears open for it.
Absolutely. So they start playing it live. They're touring for The Hurting, that album. And what starts to happen on tour is it begins to take shape as its own song. So you can actually watch footage from 1983
mm-hmm.
where they are already playing what we now know, as fans of Tears for Fears know, is this string of songs where it goes broken into Head Over Heels.
Yeah.
And then it has this sort of outro thing. They're already doing that live in 1983, way before the album comes out. So this was actually the first song written for Songs from the Big Chair because they had figured out on stage just how
there's some magic
to
here.
Translate this B-side into its extended into its own song.
Oh, I love that.
And just one more thing about it. They actually, the band, interestingly, based on what we've been saying already mm-hmm. about the band's history with the Janov and the Primal Scream and this being a love song, the band initially didn't like the song. They were like, this is a good song, but it isn't really us. They were confused by it. So I found a quote from Roland Orzabal, the lead singer, who said, Head Over Heels was tough because we were making sort of quite advanced electronic music, and then this pop song comes along. And it's like, well, what are we going to do with this? They didn't have a clue what to do with the song.
I love that. I love the fact that even they weren't quite sure what it was.
Right.
It's also weird to hear them
They're
talk
like,
about
this is good, but
this is a pop
us?
Song.
Right.
But it's not, you know, a hard-hitting electronic underground hit like Shout
right.
or Everybody Rules the World. Like it's weird to hear them say that this is a pop because I even looking back at the first album, yeah, it's really emo for the time, but
yeah.
there's some great pop writing.
It's pop writing with like some darkness and melancholy,
yeah.
which is, again, we sort of mentioned a lot of these synthy duos, like Gary Newman's very much, like a lot of these
yeah.
artists. In fact, the earliest reviews before they started putting out more singles and the fact that they looked good, when they first started putting out singles from The Hurting, they were compared to Joy Division and like sort of darker bands. They were sort of goth adjacent. That wasn't the word at the time, but
no,
these were darker
yeah.
artists. And then they started because...
I mean, look at the album art. It is kind of bleak.
And then when there started to be articles about the band and their first videos and they were good looking, I think it's interesting to see the old British press started to turn on them.
Yeah,
They're
yeah.
like, oh, these guys are another Wham.
A bunch of pretty boys from Bath.
A bunch of pretty boys from Bath. Uh-huh. And meanwhile, the lyrics are super dark. But that gets us to this song. That gets us to Head Over Heels. It is their first big love song. And it is the beginning of the breakthrough, like kind of next chapter for the band.
I love that. So we've set the stage. Two boys from
Bath
are ready to make it big. With their blend of quirky lyrics, big choruses, and weird music videos. After the break, we'll be in over our heads with Head Over Heels.
Thanks to the U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Just like notes in a song, sustainable living is just a series of small, eco-friendly choices that contribute to the melody. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on At Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Meet Gail. Her thing is being a supermom, and supermom has a lot on her super-sized plate.
Ain't that the truth?
But at Walmart Pharmacy, Supermom recently got her whole family updated on all their vaccines.
We knocked it out during a grocery run. No appointment.
That's next-level supermom. From pneumonia to shingles, HPV, and more, get no-cost vaccinations from an expert pharmacist where you already shop. Welcome to an easier pharmacy. Welcome to your Walmart. $0 copay with most insurances. State age and health restrictions may apply.
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome back to One Song. Luxury, I just want to be alone with you and talk about the weather.
Okay, I see what you did there.
I see what our producer did there, too.
That's a very Matt line, but we love you. We love it.
We love Matt Nelson. All right, but in all seriousness, I'm excited to get to these stems. Luxury, where do you want to start?
I'm so excited to get into these stems. There's so much deliciousness in this song. It's a very meticulously created song and produced. Okay. But before I get to that, I alluded earlier about the sort of unsung members of the band. So it's a duo, but this band would not exist without a couple of other people. One in particular is, I want to give Ian Stanley his flowers. So Ian Stanley is sort of the unsung third member of the band from early days.
Okay.
It was Ian Stanley, who was, by the way, if you don't know who that is, in the video for Head Over Heels. He's the kind of good-looking guy with a leather jacket who does the, like, silly keyboard solo with one finger. So memorable. We'll play you that keyboard solo in a second. But Ian Stanley...
Which he is not playing, to be clear.
I think he is playing.
He is the keyboardist in this song?
So it's a little difficult to know for sure.
Okay.
That's a perfect way into the song. Uh-huh. Lots of Rashomon going on here. She said. I've heard a couple of recent interviews with Ian Stanley where you can tell he's being so diplomatic because I think it was challenging for him to be the third member of a duo.
Sure.
So Ian Stanley is also from Bath, and he meets the boys when they're teenagers. It turns out that he has his own recording studio, and in 1980, 81, 82-ish, having access to these devices like a Lindrum and Roland Juno synthesizer.
Yeah, these were not everywhere.
These were not everywhere.
Now everything's on your laptop. Everybody comes in the studio with about eight devices.
And
this
having it in
that.
Your house is also like, that's a bonus too. You're not paying for studio time.
Oh,
so
yeah, that's a good point.
The combination of Roland and Kurt.
Now every home in Atlanta comes with a home studio.
it's mandatory.
It's just like having a kitchen. It's cool. He had the studio.
But in Bath,
he had the equipment.
In Bath, England, circa 1981,
totally.
1982, Ian Stanley shows up in their lives at the perfect time where they've got this batch of amazing songs that they're writing, but they need help producing it to get a record deal. So Ian comes into the picture. He's got the studio. He's got the equipment. And he helps program certain things like on Mad World and Change. He's got the ability to have 16th notes. So da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So he's the one helping their sound come together. The songwriting, solid. It's there. But Tears for Fears, as we know it, is songwriting. It's vocals. It's also synthesizers and drum machines.
Absolutely.
And the sound. So he's kind of the third. He's a co-writer. He gets co-writing credits on a handful of songs. That first record in particular is mostly recorded in his studio. So he's a very important person we'll talk about in a minute. The second person I want to mention is Chris Hughes, the producer of this record. He's former drummer for Adam and the Ants, by the way.
Oh, cool.
And he co-writes Everybody Wants to Rule the World, on this record as well. He is the unsung fourth member. They're both a little bit sung, a little unsung. I guess I just mentioned them in this context because I found this quote in particular from Hughes, who describes the sessions very interestingly. I didn't realize he gives us some insight into how this record was made, how this song was made. So Hughes, this is a quote from producer Chris Hughes. It was essentially Roland, Ian Stanley, and I as a three-piece. So basically the songwriting sessions, Kurt was there as an important kind of counterpart for Roland, I think, as a person, as a friend for many years, as a trusted confidant. But as Kurt himself says in another interview, he's really doing 20 to 30% of everything musical about Tears for Fears. It's about 70 to 80% Roland across the board.
At this point, yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting to kind of get that insight because you just don't know what's happening behind the scenes with the duo. Just everything seems like both of them did all of it. So the core team making this record and making Head Over Heels is Roland, Ian Stanley, and Chris Hughes.
All right, we're both drummers. I'd love to get into some drum stems.
Let's talk about the drums. So, you know what's funny about this song? It wasn't until I listened to the stems, Isolated, which I'll play for you in a second, that it dawned on me that after years of watching the video where Manny Elias, their touring drummer, is playing the drums, and he's got these really iconic fills, which I'll also play for you in a second, it wasn't until I listened to the stems that I realized that it's not a live drum track. It is a programmed Ling drum.
It's a drum.
I never noticed that until I listened. So let me play that for you.
I think to my ears, I was like, that sounds like some drum machine.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
There is a credit to, they're both credited on the album. Mm-hmm. So Manny Elias does get credited with drums. But I think that maybe on this song in particular, I think that's because there's that coda. There's that, I'm going to talk about the arrangement in a second, by the way. That's its own thing. But at the end of the song, it goes into this other song, which is, I think, taken from a live performance, which you can find on YouTube. It's exactly the same.
That's cool.
So technically, he's on the song, but it's just at the end. The rest of it's a Lin drum, and let's hear that right now. And by the way, that's the Dead giveaway right there. When you hear that da 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 da, and all of those snare hits are exactly the same, that's the Dead giveaway that it's a programmed drum machine.
Oh, wow.
It's just volume that's going up, but the sound itself is identical the entire way across.
That's hilarious.
So that was the clue that I was like, oh, wait a second. But there's some fun little, and by the way, one thing I need to point out for all of the stems we're about to hear is how meticulously crafted this song is as a song, the songwriting, but also the like little choices and decisions about like what happens in each part where. It's really beautiful. Here's an example in the drums where that beat goes through the whole thing. It's a drum machine beat, but there'll be these little tiny variations like this one here. That little thing with a hi-hat, and it matches what's happening in the strings. I'm kind of jumping ahead for a minute. You know, there's that little string pizzicato thing, which I'll play.
Oh, one of the best parts of the entire
song.
Everyone
loves that. When you hear them together, you can hear that little drum programming thing was done to kind of have a counterpoint just for that tiny string moment. So together, they sound like this. It's just this little tiny moment. This entire song has a lot of
Yeah, that's what
things.
I'm saying. Like, there are just little points that come in. They don't do them twice.
Right.
They but they're just once. There, and they're perfect.
And perfectly put, because that's one thing. In 1984, 85, when the song is being written, to be doing what you just described with drum machines and synthesizers, to be making those little variations is more challenging because, as we sort of alluded to in the New Order episode, you're programming the entire machine. You don't have a computer screen. It's much harder to do. You've got this tiny little window. You have to kind of resequence the whole thing. It's a whole world that is far more challenging than what we're used to
it's
now when
we're
making electronic music. It's a mad world.
I will say, is that a violin? What is
I'm pretty sure that's a Fairlight. I'm almost positive.
What is a Fairlight?
So a Fairlight is an early sampler / synthesizer. It's one of the more relatively affordable, because before that there was the Synclavier, which is very expensive.
Yeah.
But it's still pretty expensive. My understanding is that Ian Stanley possessed all these machines and he had a little bit of money, a little family money. So he was able to afford these devices like the Fairlight. So when I listen to this, here's that pizzicato. I'm nearly positive they didn't hire any violin players because they're not credited.
Yeah.
It's possible, but I also know that you can do that on a Fairlight.
That's super cool. That's one of those little things that they threw in there that just, it takes something that was already like at a 90 to a 95.
to maybe, and we might even get to a 99 by the time we're done.
Oh, we're going to get to 103. I think they got extra credit on this one.
Let me just play a couple of those sick, sick fills. Like I said, whenever all these years I've been watching this video, if you ever watch this video with me, I will not be able to restrain myself from playing along to these fills that Manny Elias is doing visually, but they are programmed. And here's one of them. I mean, to my ears, that could be a live drummer overdubbed, but I'm pretty sure it's not because all of the sounds, like the kick and snare
sounds.
What part
of the song is that? Can you play what part of that song comes in?
Here's the context of that. That's at the Na-Na outro. And he does one more of those. Again, I'm just going to have to do it in the room. I'm sorry, I can't help myself. I just love drum fills like that. And if
we're
going
to have to talk about you restraining yourself.
If that's what I think it is, which is, I think, a Lindrum programming that fill.
Yeah.
That is, somebody took a week. Not quite a week, but it took a long time to program those hits with such intricacy and to make it sound like a real drummer.
Yeah.
Or it's Manny Elias and just the credits don't reflect.
Well, I think the big picture about the drums of this song is that, you know, like, whether they're just turning up the volume or, you know, it's a fill, it's always building up to the next thing that's about to happen. And that sounds like 101, but a lot of people don't do it.
No, but those are the little details.
And those are the details
about
that, like, really get your, you know, they get your blood going.
And that's what tricked me all these years into thinking that it wasn't a drum machine, is that there are so many intricate little parts that it sounds like a human playing it.
Let's talk about the bass.
The bass line might be my favorite part of the song, and I say that.
We've talked about this.
Immediately think of 30 other things I also love, but this bass line is something special.
Mm-hmm.
This is Kurt Smith on bass. He's a really talented bass player. He plays bass live too.
Yeah.
I think it's a Steinberger bass. It's got this very distinctive 80s sound, which is very trebly. And this bass line is in the verse. I'm going to play it isolated, and then I'll play it for you along with the vocal. And
so that it makes its context.
Something very interesting happens, and I'll explain in just a minute.
You know what's crazy? It sounds a lot like The Pretenders. What is that song? Like, I Went Back to Ohio or whatever.
Yeah, right,
it sounds a little bit like that bass line.
I went back to Ohio, but my city was gone.
Which I would have never drawn a connection between.
Well, you know what's interesting? I did find a connection in an interview. They talk about what it was inspired by. And tell me if you hear the connection.
Yeah. Yep, I totally hear the connection. So it was inspired by David Byrne and the Talking Heads.
That's right.
Take Me to the River.
It's inspired by Take Me to the River. Yeah. That's Tina Weymouth on bass playing the Talking Heads cover of the Al Green song.
You know what people should do if you have some time? Is go on YouTube. I think it's still on YouTube. You might have to have Peacock Plus, but go watch Talking Heads perform Take Me to the River on SNL. It's one of the greatest performances that you'll ever see.
That's a band.
It's an insanely good,
like, every year my love for them just grows. With
don't
such a
know
special
why
band.
Love you like I do. I mean, like, my mind is kind of blown. Now I'm thinking about My City Was Gone by The Pretenders, Head Over Heels by Tears for Fears, and Take Me to the River by Talking Heads. There's a through line between those bass lines. That's really cool.
And I'm just looking. That song.
And I bet you could probably find some obscure Muddy Waters song that, like,
that walking bass line. Jazz.
Infected all of them.
The bass, like, walking bass lines. You can find a million jazz songs that.
But that's a really cool connection.
That is a cool connection, right?
I agree. You were gonna play the bass stem with the vocal in.
So now I'm gonna show you how that bass line is mirroring what Roland is playing. And we're going to talk more specifically in a minute about, we'll just talk about the vocals on its own. So,
don't think this is us giving you your feel of the vocals.
No.
More vocals coming.
There'll be more vocals later.
Yeah.
I wanted to be with you alone and talk about the weather.
So rhythmically, he's mirroring, and some of the melody notes even literally are mirroring what's being sung. and then going back to not mirroring it in this incredibly special way. It's counterpoint that then turns into matching, then back to counterpoint.
This honestly becomes chicken or the egg to me. Yeah. Like, did they have the vocal first and then the bass line? Or the bass line and then the vocal?
We can't know for sure.
Yeah, we can't know.
Can't know for sure.
Unless Roland, unless you're listening. Kurt, Ian, Manny, Chris Hughes.
That's right, DM all four. Us. They might have four different answers, too.
Well, I named five people because we included the producer.
The producer,
he would probably know.
The engineer, Dave Bascom, by the way, I'm glad you mentioned, is another unsung, not unsung. They're all sung in their own ways, but there are five people making this song, and he's the fifth, so I'm glad you mentioned that. So, and then in the chorus, the bass line is this, which again, I'm going to do it without the vocals and then with, and it's, again, part of the magic of the interplay. Again, this is the core duo of the band, yeah. Vocals and bass. Here is just the bass line in the chorus. And now I'll play it for you.
That really needs context, because that sounds like a completely different song.
Here it is with the vocal, and you can hear how he's sort of bobbing and weaving around the vocal.
Okay.
Something happens and I'm head over heels.
There's so many, like, wonderful decrescendos in there. Like, you're just like, holy shit, this is a lot of stuff coming together.
A lot of stuff coming together. A lot of parts that are interweaving and coming in and out and responding to each other in just the right way. We talked about, like, the funky pockets with, like, Stevie Wonder's many superstition clavinet parts.
Uh-huh.
It's doing a very similar
thing. Very similar.
It's finding a place. If it were, like, 1/16th note over or 1/2 step higher, it wouldn't work.
Wouldn't work. I love that.
Perfect interplay of parts.
Should we talk about the guitars?
Let's play some guitar parts. This is Roland on guitar. He is a really great guitar player, and you'll hear some of his interesting, intricate parts as well as his, like, wailing solo-y parts. All right, so here's Roland's guitar melody in the intro.
You know, there's a word that we don't use this often.
Okay. It's not iconic.
How did you know?
Oh, boy.
That is an iconic guitar riff right there, my friend.
It is an iconic guitar riff.
The second, let me tell you, as a person, as a veteran of the karaoke wars, when that guitar comes in, people are like, like, you know, like, people would, like, get at me. Like, you know, all the 40-year-olds really come out of their shell. That was a great guitar riff. There's probably some other guitar moments that I'm not even thinking of.
Absolutely. And it's also important to just pause for a second. Remember, these guys are ostensibly a synthy keyboard duo.
Yeah.
What starts to happen when they're live on tour for that first record is they're starting to integrate live instruments. Mm-hmm. So we have Manny Elias on drums. And in the recorded version of this song, there's a outro that's very live band. They're kind of jamming and you hear the live drums do crazy fills. Also, guitar. Guitar in a synth pop band, at the time, they were making a real choice to say, you know, we're going to have guitars. Because Gary Newman, philosophically, a lot of these bands were like, we are anti-guitar.
We're throwing away our guitars and we're buying keyboards.
So not only are they playing,
James Murphy.
Not only is that a guitar, an electric guitar, but it's playing like a kind of American sounding, like, you know, wailing.
He's wailing.
It could be a Journey, you know, Neil Sean kind of part.
Don't you dare bring Journey into this.
But it's interesting because that's a real choice they made. And I think it came out of a little bit swinging for the fences on this record. This was a record where they swung and hit big time in terms of making it big in America. But guitars were something that Americans liked and needed in their pop music. So I think that was a real conscious choice to add it. And anyway, that's this incredible counter melody to the primary one, which we'll be hearing in a second, that legendary piano ostinato. But first, let's play a little more guitar for you.
Can I say without context?
Yeah.
That sounds like Soundgarden. That sounds like some 1990s
right.
grunge.
When you don't hear it in the mix, it could be almost any kind of like,
So where in the world of this song
I'll
is
I'll give
that
you
part?
Some drums and bass so you can place how it works in the song. So that's happening very buried in the mix. You may not have noticed it all these years.
You know, when you play, I love it when you throw all the context back in there because now I'm like, oh yeah, I've heard that before. But when you hear it in isolation, you're like, that could have been its own composition.
I'm so glad you said that because across this song, there's probably 100 different melodic and rhythmic ideas.
Ideas,
and
yeah.
It's sort of the opposite of, I would say this might be like, you know, we talk about, we love and adore and worship funk music, right? Mm-hmm. But so much of funk is frequently about kind of almost setting a drone kind of hypnotic state with repetition. Mm-hmm. And the variations are kind of all happening on the vocal line and on the vocal top line. And instrumentally, if you're the bass player in or guitar player in James Brown's band, for 10 minutes, you might be playing the same part. This might be the counter opposite of that, where in a compact 4-minute song, there's probably 100 different variations happening throughout all the instruments across time. And that's part of, that's like a synth pop thing too. You'll find that in a lot of Depeche Mode and a lot of, you know, a lot of bands like that from the era.
Let's hear another guitar part.
I'm going to play one more little guitar moment. This is what we were talking about earlier, where things that just happen once and never again.
Uh-huh.
I can only find one instance of an acoustic guitar in this song. It's incredibly brief, and here it is. Right, I'll show you where that is in the mix. I'd never noticed it until I was like going through this, but it's right before the second chorus. It just happens once, a blink, and it's over.
It's just a little bit more texture, a little bit more fill. Again, I feel like this whole song is constantly like build you up, and then it brings you here, and then it builds up some more, and it brings you here, and then yeah. So when you get to that part of the song, they're probably just like, we don't want it to sound just like another part of the song.
Right.
Let's add in one more element.
Yeah.
To make it. I feel like this is like almost like a masterclass in just music creation.
Absolutely.
I mean, like, there's so many things they're putting in there. There's a math quality to it.
There's a texture quality. What we've been talking about is all of the parts, all the melody parts and the rhythmic parts. I want to take a step back for a second and talk about just the song structure, because that in and of itself is unusual.
Yeah, break it down, bro.
So this song starts with, and it's a perfect intro into our piano riff, the iconic piano riff that we've all been waiting for.
I know, we've been teasing you. It's coming.
It's interesting because that iconic intro with the piano riff is, the piano riff only happens in the intro and in the outro. The verses and the choruses, it's kind of like there's an entirely different song stuck in the middle. So we've got, I'll just tell you the structure. It's intro with piano riff, verse one, chorus one. There's that keyboard solo, which is unusual after the first chorus. Verse two, chorus two. And then we have this outro, which is like about 40% of the song.
It's long.
It's very long.
It's long, I'll tell you.
And we haven't heard that piano line since the beginning.
Yeah.
And it finally comes back.
As a person who sings this in karaoke, you don't realize until you sing this song just how many la, 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 la's there are. It's about damn near half the song.
It is literally 50% of the song. If you add the intro and the outro, that's its own song. That's about 50% of the time duration. And then there's this song kind of in the middle, the verse and chorus. And they're half and half of the song altogether. And don't forget, there's that coda tacked on the end where they go into the sort of jazz funk fusion moment, which had come from the live show. So the song has like all of these different parts, and it's both a masterclass in melodies and variation, but also in arrangement.
We're talking about Tears for Fears, Head Over Heels. We can't talk about the song without talking about the piano. And I think that our listeners have been very patient. Walk us through the piano, this wonderful piano riff that sort of makes this song the iconic song it is.
I would be more than happy to walk you through it. This is, the credit goes to Andy David, who I don't know much about, but he gets a grand piano credit. Let's hear the grand piano, which you will then hear is layered with several synth layers probably. There might be the Jupiter, there might be a Fairlight, there might be a DX7, but it all is playing a single note melody, which is just layered and is massive, and it's got reverb added, et cetera, to be the iconic. Is that the third time we've used that word today?
In the last minute.
Here it is. And that part has a little synth fill.
I just thought it was like a grand piano in a cathedral.
It sounds like a grand piano in a cathedral, absolutely. And there's a little...
really high ceilings.
A little arpeggiated synth thing that comes in the middle of that.
That happens? Let's hear it in context. Again with the builds, these guys.
They like their builds.
Roland and Kurt, you like crescendo. Your builds.
They like their crescendos and their decrescendos.
No, but I'm saying, like, it's like, okay, we've been doing this thing for, like, the last four bars, the last eight bars. So the next eight bars,
you'll
gotta
never
be
hear
different.
It again the same
there's
way.
Gotta be one more element that's in there. Because even if they don't hear it, they will hear it.
I don't think there's a single set of four bars throughout the entire song that happens exactly the same way again.
It's great.
Yeah, it's really great. And then in the verse, the piano switches to this.
I just died.
From beauty.
I just died.
It's a beauty death.
I mean, it's so good. I could literally just listen to that piano. Even though that piano is doing something very repetitious, I could listen to that piano. I don't know what they did when they recorded it, but it sounds so pure is the word I want to use. Like, it just sounds pure and strong and, like, I don't know.
Well, the addition
something
of,
that really works about
the
that
The addition
piano.
Of grand piano and live guitar, electric guitar, and then a lot of synthesizers and a drum machine.
I think for me,
it's this human machine interplay that we hear in so many songs we love.
I remember when I was like still in high school, I was like, I don't know what made me say it, but like, because I was a drummer, but I was like, the things that I like the most in songs are piano, violins, and drums.
Oh, interesting.
And for whatever reason, like,
violins.
If there's, and by the way, this has all three, because that pizzicato thing, whatever that's supposed to be, it's always heard as a violin.
I heard it as drums.
It sounds really pure. It sounds really good. I don't want to even delay. Let's hear something else.
So I mentioned Ian Stanley before. In the video, he's playing the synth solo. I'm pretty sure he also played it a lot. I do think this is a part that he came up with. And let's just listen to it. Yeah! You got to do the yeah.
Reminds me of the end of Revenge of the Nerds, you know?
I know exactly what you mean, that kind of horn.
It's a very sort of
horn
like...
Horn sound.
It's a very thin, synth-generated horn
That's
sound.
That's right. That doesn't sound like a horn.
It doesn't sound like a horn. Just to me, it sounds like the 80s.
It sounds
I feel like
80s.
I need a mullet and a headband.
Exactly. Now we have to play that. From Revenge of the Nerds? Oh, my God.
Unfortunately, I feel like
there's
nothing... The big finish. There will be whole generations that are born and die and will never know Revenge of the Nerds because there's so much problematic material in it. But maybe we can save the performance at the end
but
of the
But that's Lamont's big moment. Clap your hands, everybody. Everybody, clap your hands. And
you've
that
been
is...
asking all year to do the Lamont rap, and I'm glad you finally got it in there. You finally got
it's
it in
so
there.
It's so good.
No, it is really good. Gosh, these pianos are so good. Is there something else you want to play from the piano family?
There's these little, I found these cute little, I like, you know, I love to find cute little things. Like in Prince, Let's Go Crazy, when there's like cute little thin synthesizers you barely notice. Here's some cute thin eighth notes that I never noticed before. I'll play it in the mix.
Oh, I know this part.
So that's this little moment that happens in the second verse for again, like variety.
Sort of like a ukulele.
It's very the pluckiness is very ukulele-esque.
I've been transported to Kauai.
I was transported to Largo in the early 2000s. I'm sure some comedian there would be doing the ukulele,
ukulele
songs of the early 2000s at Largo.
All right, now we've come to the vocals. We've said a lot about Roland's singing, but now we want to hear his singing.
We're going
to
hear Roland's isolated vocals in just a moment. Now, we mentioned previously that the songwriting process is it's Kurt and Roland, and they'll decide from song to song who should be the singer.
Yeah.
In this one, you know, Roland is the lead singer, and I found this
clip. I'm sure there's some backing vocals from Kurt.
There's some backing vocals from Kurt. I think he doubles him on the falsetto part, which we'll hear in a second, and certainly the chorus. I liked this description of how they decide who sings what song. I found this great quote from Kurt, which is sort of explaining their process of how they make that choice. Kurt goes, if it's a softer song, it's normally me. If it requires being belted, it's normally Roland. My voice is a lot darker, more melancholic, and Roland is more of a shouter. He's trying to make a point, which is very loud.
Man, I'm Team Roland. Shout out to the belter from Bath.
Shout out to the shouter who shouted the song Shout.
Exactly.
One last thing to point out before we hear the vocal. We mentioned before how there's this interplay between a sort of regular voice in falsetto. This is very hard to do on every other line, which is what he's doing. A lot of times there'll be songs like we talked about.
It is hard to do.
Empire of the Sun. Oh, but this man can do it. Empire of the Sun, for example, we talked about how, like, you know, the verses are frequently just sung in normal voice.
Yeah.
And then he jumps to the chorus, he jumps to head voice.
In Empire of the Sun, he does the pouty voice, and then he goes
the pouty voice.
He goes to the falsetto.
I remember the pouty voice.
But no, this is a big back
and
forth.
You got to make this change back and forth, like, every fourth or fifth, like, note.
I wanted to be with you alone.
That is very hard to do.
It's fun, though.
I wanted to be with you alone. And talk about the weather, but traditions I can trace against the child in your face won't escape my attention.
I think you can very clearly hear Kurt add his voice to that falsetto part.
Yeah, it's in there. It's in there, but I mean, like, man, this is just like, you know, that feeling when you chills up your spine or whatever. Like, it's hard for me to hear this stuff without, like, being like,
it's so exciting.
Like, let's go to Koreatown right now. Like, forget the rest of the show. Let's just go.
You've got to get it out.
I got to shout.
You
got to
shout. Let it all out.
Let's keep going.
Let's hear the chorus.
Something happens and I'm head over heels. I don't take my heart, don't break my heart. Down, throw it away.
I feel like on this show we get really granular. How many Rollins do you think are in there?
I
feel like there might be like four. Like, it feels almost like a chorus of Rollins.
It's definitely at least double tracked, and I think Kurt is also there, probably also double tracked.
It might be three Rollins,
no
one Kurt.
No fewer than four vocals that are stacked together. There could be 16. I know that they were using 64 tracks at a certain point.
Yeah.
They could have 64 in there. It's hard to say. But what's interesting,
but it does sound like a chorus, you know, now that I hear it.
But what's interesting is that there's no harmony. There's no harmonizing. They're just singing a single note.
Something happens and I'm head over heels. I don't take my heart,
You know what I hear is I hear one Roland singing it straight and one Roland really hitting the, something happens. You know, like he's really hitting the
characters. You're right. Yeah. I think he's doing a lot of different, there's some belts.
What is that called? Like, I feel like there has to be a term for that.
For what?
is there a term?
For what?
I never find. You know, like,
oh,
you know,
I see what you're saying.
It's like an extra vamp on it. I feel like we did. We talked about it in the Britney episode.
Yeah, a lot of people got mad at us for that one.
Oh no, they get mad at us for a lot of things. but I mean, like, yeah, I love it. It's bratty.
It's bratty.
Head over heels has like it's like a little bratty. Yeah.
Let's go into verse 2. To me, might be my favorite part of the song vocally. We were talking about variety. So some of the melodies from verse 1 return, but you start to get this call and response thing. There starts to be variations, things that weren't in verse 1. And it's very sophisticated the way it's put together. There's point, counterpoint, call and response stuff going on. Without further ado, verse 2.
Have you no ambition? What's the matter with my mother and my brothers? You stupid thing ever changes when you're acting your end.
Yes! That is a part, okay. Yes! That is a part. What that little thing he does in the background, that is something, because I never had the stems, and I've only heard what was
commercially
available.
You really have to guess what that is.
I have never known what this is. Can you play that again one more time?
Changes when you're acting your end.
Dreaming, I'm awesome. Gets
done when it's hard to like be a man when there's a good thing ever changes when you're acting your end.
That was always my note. That was always my note.
That is the note.
When you hit that note, people are like, hey, let me buy you a shot.
And you've just done a falsetto.
And then you go
the
home
previous.
Too late.
That's magic. It's so much magic in what's happening vocally in this section.
They've got like 85 songs in this song. Like, I feel like nowadays they'd be like, they would take each individual part that's good and make that the song.
You could probably extricate 20 amazing songs from all the melodies and
100
ideas
songs
going on
in here.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
It's super cool.
It's so satisfying that they've made it a compact 3.5-minute pop song, 4-minute pop song.
Layer on layer. And so, like, even as you're grooving to this part, there's something in this ear, like, singing something completely different, and, like, I love that.
It's got that wonderful thing that a perfect pop song has, where everything that's happening, you're excited about, but you're also, like, anticipating the next exciting thing that's about to happen. You're like, oh, that next part's coming. Oh, that part's coming up. Oh, that part's coming up.
You know, when you go to Cold Stone, you don't just get your flavor. You You're like, you know what? I'm going to put some caramel on this. That's... Yeah. And then right when the time's right, I'm going to drop some toffee in. Like, they're giving you, like, additional sweets at every turn.
That's the exact metaphor, analogy, simile, whatever the hell that was.
I don't know what that was. But I like it because it really is about, like, pouring, like, a little bit of extra. Yeah. And then I like their restraint.
Yeah.
I like the restraint.
Is there restraint in this
there
song?
There is restraint in the song because they only did that pizzicato once.
Oh, I see what you mean.
They don't do that, right. That thing about nothing ever changes when you're acting your age. That doesn't happen in the first verse.
Like, it's not restraint in terms of all of the ideas they're going to pour into the song, but it's restraint that any of these ideas happens ever again.
You know, we're going to talk about samples in a second. But one song of theirs that I really, really like is Sowing the Seeds of Love. I've always felt, even when I was a kid listening to it, that it was their attempt to do a Sgt. Pepper's-esque
Beatles song. Yes, very Sgt. Pepper. Very George Martin.
But there were about four songs in Sowing the Seeds of Love. And so it goes from one part to another part. They're really crafting, like, classical level songs with, like, you know, this is the first fugue, and then we're going to go to this part, like... And then we're going to come back to that part at the beginning. They're really operating on, like, almost like a classical.
And level. The mastery of the fact that that is in a top 40 pop song, that's what makes it so incredible.
Let's bring that back.
This was on the radio and it was a huge hit. You know, it wasn't number one. It was only
number
three.
Again, they were losers.
Indelible pop classic, though, which we adore to this day, your number one karaoke song.
I'm so on board.
All of that with all the complexity, that's a mastercraft right there.
Kiss with another vocal.
And we get about 90 seconds of that, by the way. There is the closing line in my mind's eye. And the la-las, it's interesting. We were thinking about it because it's obviously a trope, right? It's like, where have we heard this before? Well, how many songs can you name with a la-la ending?
Okay, so let's say something real quick. People know me. They know that I'm a writer by trade. Mm-hmm. I love great lyrics. To me, la-la-la is like, ironically, the first two letters in lazy. Like, I usually hate it. You know, and I can think of a million songs, everything from la 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 la, he goes around the world like la 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 la, and la 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 la, like Kylie Minogue, which actually I kind of like that song, but like usually I am anti-la. But the fact that they somehow pull it off, I feel like by the time they get to their laws, they've earned the la. Because I think there's just something catchy in a song about an occasional la. You know what I mean? Like it's just, you don't have to even speak English to enjoy an English song with the word la 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 all over it.
Exactly. And I love also the reference, which seems to be baked into it. I mean, the three songs that jumped to my head that have done that, Coda, that's a la la coda, is... Right, so we got Hey Jude in 1970 does the la la coda.
Sure.
And then in 1971, we have T-Rex doing it in Hot Love. And then in 1972, David Bowie does it in Starman. So I think there's a little nod, a little tip of the cap to these famous la-la outros.
We don't have to disagree. I'm going to disagree. I think that there is I think if you go across genres, maybe with the exception, ironically, of hip-hop, there are so many. I mean, like if somebody tried to compile all the songs on Spotify of like, these are the la-la-la songs... I think you'd be there forever.
I agree.
I think it's a choice you make. I think la is just an easy word to say. But again, I think they've earned it. I mean, like, you know, I want to say a little bit about the lyrics of this song. If you ever have the opportunity, it's worth checking out some of the lyrics. I mean, like, you're talking about, you know, one of my favorites was, but traditions I can trace against the child in your face won't escape my attention. Like, to a certain extent. I don't know. And I feel bad because
What does it mean to you?
I went digging for, you know, sort of like the definitive, this is what head over heels means lyrically. I'm kind of glad that there are a lot of theories out there.
Yeah.
And none that I saw coming from the band themselves.
I think that's the way it should be. Yeah, I think it's great to have your own interpretation. And I don't know if I would believe the band if they had. Because, by the way, over time, I've been researching this stuff. Yeah. There's so frequently the band talking about the meaning changes from one decade to the next. They had a meaning at the time. Maybe it changes over time. Maybe they decide to answer it differently.
And it changes for
your interpretation is all that matters.
My father was a painter. Yeah. And I went to a lot of art gallery openings with him. And I would hear him tell, you know, people would inevitably ask, John, what does this painting mean? And I would hear one explanation, and then literally a week later, we'd be at another art gallery, and he'd be like, same painting, completely different explanation.
And he probably had genuine, authentic answers that just changed.
My dad wasn't trying to, like, trick. Right. Yeah, like, I think he was just like, you know, even my interpretation of some of my work, you know. And then sometimes I think it was just because he knew this person was probably looking for one explanation, right, another person.
Or he was sick of giving the same answers, so he had to make himself interested.
Like, sometimes it was dad being a little mischievous. But, you know, I think it's cool when we sort of leave it up to the listener to determine what
Do you think that line is about?
I have no idea. I don't know what the child in her face is, but I can imagine what the child in her, maybe it's the child in your, you know, Spielberg famously said, if you want to, he famously said to his child actors, you know, just, you have to look at it as if it's something you've never seen before. And to his adult actors, he would say, imagine you're a 9-year-old seeing it for the first time. And that's how you always get that Spielbergian look of, like,
wonder,
you know, Jaws, you know, like whatever
that is. I think you're nailing it too specifically with this band, because almost every song through this period, the first two records in particular, there's something to do with childhood. I mean, he's literally talking about when I was a child. Everybody Wants to Rule the World is kind of like the childhood need for power when you feel powerless as a child. Shout, Shout, Let It All Out is I Wasn't Heard, So Listen to Me Now.
Yeah.
This song also feels of a piece with that, because it's talking about, you know, my mother and my brothers used to breathe in clean air, dreaming I'm a doctor. So he's sort of a
dreaming
child,
I'm a doctor is one of my favorite
That's
lines.
A childhood
line.
Yeah,
it takes me back to when I thought, you know what, I'm just going to do really well in school and get a really safe job so that mom and dad never have to worry about money.
Wow.
You know,
That's
but
powerful.
I was a pretty happy kid. I think that it's actually one of the bigger ideas that I hope that we've sort of unpacked is that in a lot of Tears for Fears music, there is this idea of childhood trauma and the way that it, you know, shapes us in growing up and our relationships. I think we all hear all that in their music, and I hope that some of that has come through. And by the way, due to today's show, I learned new lyrics that I love from this song that I didn't know until
today. Never noticed before?
Nothing ever changes when you're acting your age. I didn't know that until today.
Interesting.
I'm so thankful that we have the stems. Thank you for playing that, because I didn't know that. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my previous favorite line from the song. It's hard to be a man when you've got a gun to your head.
Wow.
I always thought that was a very, you know, cinematic line.
Yeah, right.
You know.
I can picture that. Right.
Gets the people going. So, again, I think that, you know, lyrics.
That's the ultimate, like,
writing.
Childhood fear, too, right? Like, guns and power and, you know, it's hard to be a man. How can I grow up if there's a gun to my head?
I'm such a shallow kid. I was just like, it's hard to be a man when there's a gun to your head. I'm John McClane. You know, like, I was just thinking. But you, of course, have brought it back to
fantasies
childhood
of childhood
trauma.
Power. Yeah, childhood
power. Yeah. I love it. Before we wrap up, I want to tell everybody listening again, please go back and check out that music video. It is hilarious. In addition to the singer Roland trying to get the attention of a sexy librarian that you clearly
have not gotten over her. No, she's beautiful.
Get it.
I love her.
We can find her. There's the internet. You're married.
I'm okay.
You're
good. I'm good now.
The fact that it's shot inside a library. There's a random dude in a gas mask. Like I said, there's a chimp dressed in a Red Sox uniform, making that chimp the most mature Red Sox fan in Fenway. Boston twice in one episode.
I'm gonna stay away from that smoke.
Hey, man, I went to college up in that city.
I don't want
to
catch a strike.
Boston knows how I feel. All right, so we've said a lot about Head Over Heels, which I think its legacy, ultimately, other than being a perfectly crafted pop song with amazingly smart lyrics, it will also go down as my favorite karaoke song. Let me ask you, what is your favorite karaoke song?
Oh, damn. Well, we recently had a karaoke night, The Heartbeat, the One Song Team, and I had a lot of fun with Weezer's Buddy Holly. That one just, like, worked
for me.
If we were about to go do it right now, that would be my first choice.
Well, you know what?
Maybe I would definitely join you for this one. I would belt it out with you at the end.
Maybe we can get Roland to DM us, and maybe we can get Rivers Cuomo to come on the show sometime.
That'd be fantastic.
That would be really a lot of fun. Hey, Luxury, help me in this thing.
Okay. Well, I'm producer, DJ, musicologist, and songwriter, Luxury.
And I'm actor, writer, director, and sometimes DJ, Diala Riddle.
And this has been
Interpolation.
Nope, this has been
Interpolation.
No, got it wrong again. This has been One Song. We will see you next time.
Maybe.
Please return. Please come back.
I'm
sorry.
I am coming back. This is a sustainable show and a sustainable set. Thank you to the United Soybean Board. And we'll see you next time. This episode was produced by Matthew Nelson with engineering from Marcus Hahn. Additional production support from Casey Simonson. The show is executive produced by Kevin Hart, Mike Stein, Brian Smiley, Eric Eddings, Eric Weil, and Leslie Guam.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.